Now, if I'm honest, I struggle a little bit with this particular gospel story. We're told by the text itself that this story of the wedding in Cana, when Jesus listens to his mother and turns water into wine, this, we're told, was the first of his signs. But whenever I hear this story, all I hear really is the water into wine bit. And I struggle with this miracle. A miracle with which Jesus will forever be strongly identified. A while back, there was a meme doing the rounds on social media. A grocery store had seemingly mistakenly stocked its red wine under a sign that said water. The photo was captioned quite simply, "Jesus was here." Back when I was a kid, I loved the movie version of Jesus Christ Superstar. In it, a highly stylized and sneering King Herod, in the midst of his colorful entourage of sycophants and flamboyantly dressed hangers-on, sings the memorable line, "So you are the Christ, the great Jesus Christ. Prove to me that you're divine. Change my water into wine." And so he goes on. If you haven't seen it for a while, or if you haven't seen it at all, I'll link to it when we post the sermon online. It's interesting to me that as a culture, we've gotten so snagged on the water into wine. I too get snagged on it. It seems like such an utterly frivolous miracle. Surely, this isn't the way the world comes to know Jesus is God. Of all the astonishing things that Jesus could do, why on earth turn gallons of water into fine wine for a bunch of people at an anonymous wedding who we're led to believe are already a little bit sloshed by the time it's served? Unless, of course, the miracle isn't really the thing, right? Unless Jesus turning water into wine, the fact that he could do that, unless this isn't the point of the story at all. After all, for most of human history, reality has been thick with magic and miracle. Magicians, sorcerers, miracle doers of all sorts were all over the place. And many of them had dedicated groups of disciples. Doing a miracle here and there really wasn't that extraordinary. The metaphysical reality for folks in much of the world for most of human existence has been full of demons and angels and other worldly creatures of all kinds, and with charismatic folks who could work with them or against them, do wonders, and even bring folks back from the dead. So being able to do a miracle might make you interesting, or popular, or even entertaining, but it wouldn't necessarily make you God. Part of the genius of the scene with King Herod in Jesus Christ Superstar is that he's clear, he wants the showmanship of a miracle, right? He wants the razzle-dazzle of proof. That's how he wants or needs God to show up. He wants to be impressed. And I'm not sure he's alone in that. All through the Bible, folks are looking for signs, asking for signs. Maybe it's a human thing, that we look for something with impact, to believe that something is important. If the miraculous, the marvelous, is what we're looking for, maybe even longing for, it stands to reason it might be what we end up looking at in this story. But if we look away, we look away from the marvel of copious amounts of water being turned into wine, what's left? What else is going on in this story? Well, running in the background of this early episode in the narrative of Jesus' life is a bunch of stuff we can extract meaning from. There's a bunch of stuff, arguably, that holds ancient, symbolic, and enduring meaning. The reading begins on the third day. In the story of creation in Genesis, on the third day, the world gets plants and vegetation of all sorts. There is now life where there was no life before. In the Exodus story at Mount Sinai, Moses consecrates the people so that they might directly encounter God on the third day. And then they were given the law, which is fullness of life through covenant with God. And Jonah, the reluctant prophet who ran from his call to confront the people of Nineveh and was swallowed by a great fish, he was spat out on the third day in order to bring salvation to those who had turned away from God and so were close to death. Next, we have the wedding. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, the marriage metaphor is used as a way to understand God's relationship with ancient Israel. It is covenant. It is binding and lasting, the forming of a household or family within which there can be safety and security, trust and mutuality, and fullness of life. And finally, there is the wine. Again, in the Hebrew Bible, quality wine in abundance is understood to be a clear symbol of God's blessing. So what we have here behind the captivating distraction of the miracle is an affirmation that this is the beginning of God's new creation, God's new covenant. In Jesus, there is newness of life, blessed and in abundance and freely available for all, and it is good. What began at Jesus' baptism is now flowing out into the world, and with the help of others, it is witnessed and experienced, is tasted and understood, at least by his mother and the disciples. Just as it was in the creation story in Genesis and on Mount Sinai in Exodus, at the wedding at Cana, God's glory is revealed, and revealed in abundant life. Our response to the story of the wedding in Cana can expose our habits of attention, which maybe haven't changed that much in 2,000 years. Our attention can still get snagged on the bling. We can't help but pay most attention to what's flashy or loud, surprising or impressive. And we get snagged, we still get snagged on the ever-present bluster of the theatrics on constant display in the world around us. And then we can start to look for signs of God or of what's coming in all the wrong places. And we can jump to a heap of unhelpful conclusions based on what it is that we're paying attention to. We have habits of attention, and these habits can have us miss the fuller story of what's going on, what's constant and always there, but can get lost in the clatter. We live in a world that is infused with meaning and life and possibility. But when we get caught up in the show of it all, it's so much harder to see hope in all the ways, always present, often in the background, all the ways that newness and fullness of life always remains possible. If we give our energy and our attention to the theater of the moment, then we're giving that our energy, we're giving our attention and energy to that which doesn't last, to that which does not offer life in abundance for all, or freedom for all, or justice for all. And then we risk missing the real point of it all, living not in life-giving response to the glory of God, but in life-leaking reaction to the pomp and circumstance of the present moment. Let's not get snagged by the attention-grabbing drama or flashy spectacle of the noisemakers. Our God is ever present in the barely audible whisper. Grace flows in subtle, constant abiding. God is in the often overlooked stuff, unnoticed in the midst of an attention-hungry world. So let's keep our eye on love and hope, our minds on freedom and justice for all, and our energy dedicated to co-creating a world in which fullness of life for all people, abundant life, that's what has our attention.